Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. For the present, my answers are posted every other week on Mondays, and Dr. Yaron Brook answers questions on current events on the alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off at the end, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. I am blocked in committing to a romantic relationship because I'm afraid that when I get into one, I will have made the wrong choice and be trapped. The grass is always greener on the other side. What is the morality of this dilemma? By the way, the grass is always greener on the other side. The meaning of it is, it isn't greener on the other side. It looks greener on the other side till you get there. This is the exact opposite of what you intended it to mean. You ever hear the expression from the ancient Epicureans? You know, the all-out hedonist said, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. And by the time I got to Epicurus, he was in the period where civilization was waning. And the slogan of his school was, neither eat, drink, nor be merry, lest tomorrow you diet. And that's basically what you're saying. You're giving up the positives because of fear of the negative. Or they used to say, the Stoics used to say, they don't want to give hostages to fortune. In other words, if they like something in the world, they can be hurt. They can be disappointed, etc. So if they like nothing, they're immune to being hurt. Of course, they are immune to being happy and enjoying life also. You're suggesting a philosophy of fear above values. If you follow that philosophy, you couldn't commit to anything. For instance, to a career. What if you make the wrong choice and you put in all that time and learning and get up to a certain point, oh my God, I'm trapped in the wrong one. And all those years thrown away. So basically, you could not do anything long range by this philosophy. Now, your whole argument is, I have made the wrong choice and be trapped. Now, why are you trapped if you make the wrong choice in a romantic relationship? Is she tying you down? Have you, become a Siamese twin of hers? What is to prevent you from saying, you know, in a nice way if you can, you know, I loved you, etc., but, etc., you know, dear Jane instead of dear John. You know, I can imagine cases where you would be trapped, like you meet her and things are great and you have five kids across 4 years and then you decide you don't love her and you're trapped. There I would say, you know, you better be pretty sure before you multiply like that. But even there, if you discover it's really wrong, and if you can support the kids, you should go ahead and do it. I don't know what is trapping you, why you're afraid of that, what the other person can do to you. You can always say in a nice way, you know, it's not working out. You don't even have to say, I'm not in love with you anymore. In your book, The Dim Hypothesis, you described the three approaches to integration and their role in shaping Western culture and history. In Opar, you describe Western history as the philosophical duel between Plato and Aristotle, a duel between otherworldliness and this world. How do these two perspectives on history relate to each other? Well, they're the same, but they are different. In the Plato-Aristotle viewpoint, I'm looking at a question broadly. Kant and Plato both are advocates of another world, but Kant is the numeral world, and say this world is a world of appearance. Kant and Plato both say perception is irrelevant to this world, but our means of knowledge, the only thing we can rely on, is concepts either innate or through memory. and both advocate sacrifice. So from the point of view of a book, I did this really in copying The Ominous Perils, and from the point of view of that book, it was not necessary to make a subdivision. Although I could have benefited from making that subdivision. I didn't know it or I didn't think of it as that important, but I didn't because this was what I was trying to relate. Now I came to the Dim book. I did not have in mind how I would explain the development of a country or, you know, Nazism or anything of that kind. I had in mind, I want to follow this, but from the point of view of epistemology, not other world versus this world or sacrifice, etc., but specifically concepts and concept formation. So following that, there is a very, very major, on that count, very major difference between Plato and Kant. Because Plato thinks that concepts are the key to another true reality, and Kant thinks that concepts are the destroyer which cuts us off from reality. That's the essence of his nihilism. So once I saw that, I had to make it three. I did not appreciate in my earlier books the role of nihilism, what I call D2. I really didn't think that was really so significant as I found out. So my earlier books weren't wrong, but if I did them again, I would put in Kant because I now think that the difference between Plato and Kant is just as important as the similarity and very helpful in understanding history of philosophy, history of the West. Here's a philosophy student, I'm putting this in my own words. He's alone in a hostile class, philosophy class. And occasionally he puts forth some Ayn Rand ideas, and sometimes he gets a reaction. But he goes on, out of class, I lose the respect that these students had for the correct ideas I just mentioned. Should I stop speaking in class altogether? How do I avoid becoming a martyr while maintaining integrity and honesty? Well, it's a baffling to me if they like to hear you in class, why they don't want, the same ones at least, don't want to hear it out of class. Is it that you know, are brief and non-dogmatic in class, and when you get outside, you start a whole spiel on objectivism and turn them off? I don't know, but I have to know the answer to answer that. But let's say you're right about you lose the respect they had for you in class if they talk about it. In other words, they lose their respect for you because of your ideas. Well, the question would be, what are the practical results on you? Is there going to be a vote, you know, like in progressive schools, at the end of the semester, and they're going to give you a grade? Now, that certainly would be a significant practical factor. You might very well say, I'm not going to court their negativity if this is at stake. Or you might think there's something actual to gain, something rational to gain. And if so, and if it can be gained in those circumstances, why stop speaking? Although it's hard for me to imagine what you will gain from it. The way you are presenting, and I can only assume yours is correct, I would keep silent in that situation. Or talk to only those whom you have some indication, are open at least to new ideas. Otherwise, as you presented, you're just walking into a beehive. Now, you say, how do I avoid becoming a martyr? Well, what is a martyr? I looked that up, and a martyr is someone who has major suffering or death inflicted on him in order to remain loyal to some of his ideas, one or more of his ideas. Now, I don't think that this situation qualifies for martyr. The worst you can say is becoming lonely. How do I avoid becoming lonely? And there I'd say, look around. It looks to me like you're coming from India. Look around, or I think they have a computer everywhere there, but you're exaggerating to say that you're on the way to becoming a martyr. Would two people who love each other ever separate or divorce? Yes, certainly, under certain circumstances. Now, he goes on to give his story, but I have to condense it. But in essence, he says that he is completely in love with this girl, but he describes symptoms which I would say are bipolar, you know, rapid alternation, or not so rapid, between depression and elation. And finally, it became impossible to live with, so he had to leave. And he says, is that kind of thing ever, or does it ever happen between two rational people, or two people who aren't really in love, rather? And I would say, yes, you could certainly imagine a separation or divorce from two people who are in love if the element that provoked the love that you were loving atrophies or disappears. You're not guaranteed that the person will remain identical by going into your relationship. And people can have mental issues such as you describe. They can have just simply character changes across time. They can make choices that make them gradually become a different person to you. And you have to decide. Or you can come across a barrier so profound that you didn't know about that even though you tried to know everything, that you just can't see continuing the relationship. For instance, I know some couples that were really in love and were pretty sure that they did not want children. And at a certain point, the wife did, and it became crucial to her. And the man did not, and they separated. They divorced. I think they loved each other, but they had a completely different idea of lifestyle, and that took precedence.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.